Hi, good afternoon, listeners. This is Ken here with Gus and Marchand. We have an interesting show today on genetic engineering. This show is on a live public affairs call-in show. We'll be taking calls later on in the show. We'll be giving out the number. And if you want to reach us, you can by email, you can write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. And our show is on Mondays between 12 noon and 1 p.m. every Monday except the first Monday of the month. A couple things I'd like to mention before we get into our show today is, of course, Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah to our listeners as those wonderful holidays approach. I'd like to also note that next Monday we present our monthly war report, which I believe is unique in radio, where we do a thorough analysis of recent developments in the global wars. And we often include details that are not reported well in the corporate media. And I also like to mention those of you who have a special interest in food who are tuning in today that we cover this subject every week, every Thursday at noon on the Organic Farm Stand with Richard Hill and Guy Beardsley. So be sure to tune into the Organic Farm Stand on Thursdays at noon. So today we're going to talk about genetically engineered food. Is it safe? Gus, can you introduce our very special guest today?
Our guest today is Jeffrey Smith, the well-known and well-spoken author of the best-selling book Seeds of Deception. He's regarded as the foremost book on genetically engineered food. And you want to switch mics? Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, folks. Technical difficulties.
No big deal.
Get me up.
Yep, you're good.
Does that sound good? Okay, good. As I was saying, Seeds of Deception is regarded as the foremost book on genetically engineered food, and Jeffrey Smith is the founder of the Institute for Responsible Technology. And I met Jeffrey over the summer at the Greenwich Audubon Society when he gave one of his presentations. And I have to say, folks out there, if you hear that Jeff's coming to your town, get out there to go see him. Go meet him. He's a nice guy. He will answer all your questions. He is a really inspiring lecturer when talking about this stuff. And, you know, the depth of knowledge that I can attest to is really, really important, because to be able to talk about this topic on a level that everyone can understand but not lose the science is really important, because when you hear the propaganda from the genetically modified food industry, they're coming at you from all these angles that you can't even comprehend. And Jeffrey, are you with us right now?
I am.
All right.
Yep.
Thanks for being with us, Jeffrey.
Pleasure.
All right, so we are so happy to have you today, and I think we're going to start off with just a little basic knowledge on what GM, is it genetically modified organism, the GMO, or is it genetically engineered? What's the difference, or what exactly is genetic modification?
Well, the answer is yes. Either way will work.
Okay.
It's genetic modification. Some people like to use the term for any change in the gene, but that's not how most people in the world use it. It's mostly the swapping genes from one species to another, and then creating whole new organisms that are not part of the billions of years of evolution.
Okay. And how are GM foods finding their way into our food supply today?
Well, there are nine genetically modified food crops, and the most popular ones are soy and corn, and also canola and cottonseed, both used for vegetable oil, and sugar from sugar beets and alfalfa for animal feed. And unfortunately, even though those are only five crops, the other three are Hawaiian papaya and a little zucchini and crookneck squash, those five are found in maybe 70 to 80% of all the foods in the supermarket, because there's so many processed foods that contain derivatives of soy, corn, cottonseed, canola, and sugar. So the other exposure is animal feed, of course. Animals fed the crop remnants of all of those five. And the bovine growth hormone, which is a genetically engineered drug injected into cows to increase milk supply, that's found in a small percentage of dairy cows, maybe 10-12%, we don't know exactly, but that is linked to cancer and higher rates of fraternal twins, according to the fact that there's a new hormone or an increased incidence of a particular hormone in the milk, which has a lot of peer-reviewed studies relating it to these dangers.
Jeffrey, what do you say to those who argue that a genetically engineered food is just the next step from breeding?
Well, this is the argument made by the public relations departments of the biotech industry, and pretty much every one of their myths has turned out to be untrue. GMOs are not needed to feed the world. They actually lower yields on average. The world's experts at feeding the world have said that GMOs have nothing to offer. They claimed, the biotech industry claimed that it would decrease the use of agricultural chemicals, and it's increased them dramatically. They claim it's been proven safe, and we now have doctors, organizations, and many others saying we should prescribe non-GMO diets to everyone because of the risks shown in animal feeding studies.
Mm-hmm.
As far as being the next step, it certainly is a more recent example of how to manipulate the DNA, but most of the fundamental assumptions used as the basis for safety claims when they were trying to promote GMOs back in the early 90s have proven to be wrong. And so they got the technology wrong. It's based on obsolete assumptions and false assumptions. And a lot of the thoughts that it would be safe have been blown out the window because the very process itself causes massive collateral damage in the DNA, which could cause an increase of allergens, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems.
Could you talk about how the genetically engineered material is created? I was amazed by the description. It has to do with blasting material out of a kind of gene gun. Could you talk about
exactly
how that process works?
If you take, let's say you want to create corn that produces its own pesticide and register it as a pesticide, which is in fact what they do, you take soil bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, and you take the gene out of that bacterium and you make millions of copies and put it into a gun and then shoot the gun into a plate of millions of cells, hoping that some of the genes make it into the DNA of some of the cells. Then you clone the cells into a plant, and now every single cell of that corn plant has a little spray bottle which sprays BT, which breaks open the stomach of insects and kills them. Now, gene gun methods is one, and the other is using bacteria to infect or smuggle the gene into the DNA before cloning. Now, whether you use the gene gun method or the bacterial infection method, it ends up that 2 to 4% of the DNA ends up different when you insert the small gene. Now, that 2 to 4% is not the gene. That's just a small percentage of it. It's hundreds or thousands of mutations up and down the DNA. And
they're not necessarily predictable.
No, they're completely unpredictable, and they're not evaluated before the crops go on the market. So when Monsanto produced its BT corn called Mane 10, which is the most popular variety, they never tested to see if there were dramatic changes, but some independent studies have found that 43 different proteins have dramatically increased or decreased their presence, including a new protein, which was not part of corn normally, but it's part of Monsanto's corn, and it's a known allergen. And so that means some people might have an allergic reaction, possibly even death, from consuming a genetically modified corn and eating a substance that no one in the regulatory agencies have ever looked at or cared to look at. And Monsanto's soy has as much as sevenfold increase of a known soy allergen and a doubling of an anti-nutrient which blocks the absorption of certain nutrients. And so this is the background noise that they ignore, which actually means that no GM crop today with the current primitive technology can be considered safe. Even no matter if you put a very good beneficial gene in there, you could still create death as a result of it, which is what happens in human gene therapy, where they bring in a certain gene and they turn out it accidentally turns on an oncogene and causes leukemia or kills some of the patients. This is what happens in human gene therapy, where they have a lot more controls. They don't even look for this kind of stuff when they do the genetic engineering with plants.
Yeah, this is incredibly important information for everybody out there listening. And this sparked a thought in my head just a moment ago when you're talking about incorporating foreign DNA and genes into another species or another plant. And this reminded me of the irresponsible vaccine creations, where they create the vaccine within, say, a chicken or a cow or a pig or something like that, and then they inject that into people. So you're introducing recombinant cross-species DNA into a human, and that causes all kinds of susceptibilities to things like the bird flu or the swine flu, and that's how those things get introduced in cross-species. But you told an interesting story when I heard you at the Audubon Society, where you talked about, I think it might have been green beans from, I think, Australia or New Zealand or something like that, where they had a new gene introduced, and then they exported it to someplace else that actually killed people before they had even verified that it was safe. And as soon as that happened, I think New Zealand outlawed it. Is that correct?
Well, not quite. It's a little different. It's Australia.
Okay.
And they never did commercialize the peas. What happened was
peas, okay.
They took genes from kidney beans and they put them into peas in order to make the peas into insecticides that would kill certain the pea weevil.
It sounds logical.
Yeah, of course. You know, turn them into deadly peas. Why not?
So the idea the peas would be eaten by the insects. The insects
would die. They put the peas through all the normal tests that biotech developers do. And they passed with flying colors and were able to be introduced anywhere in the world. But the developers decided to do one more test that no crop developer for food had done before or since with GMOs. They did an advanced immunological test with mice. And it turns out that they gave the natural protein from the bean before it was transferred to the mice and there was no problem. Then they gave the identical protein, but this was produced from the same gene that had been swapped from the beans to the peas. So it was the identical protein with the same amino acid sequence, but this time when they administered it to the mice, there was dramatic inflammatory responses suggesting that the harmless pea had become deadly, but possibly able to create anaphylactic shock in human beings. Now, they were very surprised because it was the identical protein, and they found using another study, which is almost never done, that there was a subtle change in the way the sugar molecules attach themselves, and they said, ah, so this is why GMOs have turned deadly, so we'll bury the peas instead of export them to India to feed the people. Now, it turns out that the change that occurred with the peas could easily happen with the GMOs on the market already. They could be creating deadly anaphylactic shock, and they have never been tested in the way that the peas were. The peas, remember, passed all the tests that the other GMOs had passed. So it's an example that the regulatory system is completely broken and doesn't look at really fundamental dangers. And so we have anecdotal evidence, or let's say correlational evidence, where soon after GM soy was introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
When GMOs were introduced in the United States in 96, 7% of Americans had at least 3 chronic illnesses. 9 years later, it was 13%. Food allergies have skyrocketed. Autism has skyrocketed. Reproductive disorders have occurred. In fact, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine says that the animal feeding studies show reproductive problems, immune system problems, gastrointestinal problems, accelerated aging, organ damage, dysfunctional regulation of cholesterol and insulin, the same kind of things we're seeing in the human population. So the doctors group says no one should be eating GMOs. Every doctor should prescribe non-GMO diets.
Now, this is just so interesting. We have a society where, you know, we think that we're eating healthy by feeding our kids vegetables, but instead we're putting poisons into our bodies. And you're talking about these inflammatory reactions to some of these crops. And is this related, or could it be related, or could it be caused into the rise of things like irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's disease, or, you know, additional things that previously were almost unheard of or almost never happened, except for a very small portion of society, and now all of a sudden, you know, almost everybody you know has some kind of allergy or reaction or you know, some kind of bowel syndrome problem or something like that?
I interview a lot of physicians, and they believe, many of them believe, that GMOs in general, and probably the BT corn in particular, is in fact disrupting the gastrointestinal walls, causing irregularity, permeability, inflammation. And they're telling me that when they prescribe non-GMO diets, things like irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, and other things that have very intense symptoms that are debilitating for people can go away. And I've interviewed some of the patients that had irritable bowel, that had other things, and they say that they're getting better very, very quickly after switching to non-GMO foods. Now, with the humans involved, there's cofactors, because if someone wants to avoid GMOs, they can buy organic, but that means they're now getting organic, which is a healthier food in general that's 25% more nutrients, et cetera, on average, and they get rid of a lot of the dangerous pesticides. So you don't know which is the factor. But when you talk to veterinarians and farmers, when they've taken animals from a GM diet, and the only thing they did was switch to non-GM soy and corn, and the rest of the animal feed was the same, they're seeing dramatic increases in health, they're seeing lower death rates, higher rates of litter sizes, overall health improved. And these are the only thing they did was switch from GM to non-GM. When you look at the organs in the slaughterhouses of stomachs of pigs, for example, you see ulcers and all sorts of irregularities there. And, you know, one doctor I spoke to, a scientist, he said, we're seeing the kind of disruptions in the animals, in the labs, that we're seeing with kids with autism. The disrupted digestive tract, and also the changed behavior. And this is what I find to be particularly concerning, because so many people are exposed to GMOs. We're seeing an unprecedented rise in childhood disorders that we've never seen before, like kids with Crohn's and all that. And you don't normally see that, but it's huge now, and kids are most at risk from the dangers of GMOs. Yeah. Or they're getting them even from soy infant formula and then whatnot.
Jeffrey, we'd like to invite our listeners to ask you questions. I'm going to give out the call number. It's 203-336-9756 to speak with Jeffrey Smith about genetically engineered foods. Are they safe for your health? You're listening to In Context on WPKN. The call-in number again is 203-336-9756. If you prefer to send us an email, we'll relay the question to Jeffrey. You can write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Jeffrey, could you talk about how it came to be that the federal government did not regulate these genetically engineered foods back from, I guess, 1992 in the Bush administration?
Exactly. There was a policy on May 29th that said the agency is not aware of information showing that GMOs are significantly different. Therefore, no testing was necessary. No labeling was necessary. Companies like Monsanto, who told us that PCBs, Agent Orange, and DDT were safe, can determine if their GMOs are safe and put it on the market without telling the FDA or consumers. Now, it turns out that the whole basis of this hands-off position was a lie. They not only were aware of the fact that GMOs were significantly different, but 44,000 secret internal FDA memos made public from a lawsuit showed that the overwhelming consensus among the scientists working at the agency were that GMOs were dangerous and could lead to hard-to-detect allergens, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They complained over and over again about the drafts of the policy, which they said was systematically removing any of the science and the concerns and just basically siding with industry and the lie that there's no side effects. So as the policy went up to the higher levels of the appointees in the FDA, which included Monsanto's former attorney, who later became Monsanto's vice president and is now the U.S. Food Safety Czar, he was the one in charge of FDA policy. He's the one that said Monsanto should be in charge of determining if their foods are safe. And then when it was handed up to the Office of Management and Budget and the White House Counsel and whatnot, they wanted the policy to even look even cleaner so that there was no possible indication that these things were different. So as the same dangerous GMOs were pushed to higher levels of the political spectrum, they became safer and safer to form the basis of this false policy that there's no difference.
Now, we see this everywhere in society. It's completely prevalent. We're completely saturated with this kind of cronyism. And that's why I say we don't have a capitalist system. We have crony capitalists. And it's just nothing but insiders with a revolving door and the lobby firms going back and forth into the departments of the government. And, you know, one of the big things that, you know, a candidate like Ron Paul wants to do is eliminate many of these departments in the federal government to remove their ability to be controlled by the different lobbyists and private corporations.
It seems like Gus and Jeffrey, it seems like a lot of the function of the government is to punish the honest scientist.
Completely.
Could you tell the story, Jeffrey, of Arpad Pusztai, the researcher in Scotland?
Sure. He was actually given $3 million by the UK government to do a test of how to test for GMO safety. No one knew. You know, it was the mid-1990s. GMOs were already on the market. No peer-reviewed published studies had come out, or they were about to come on the market, and he was supposed to figure out what the protocols were going to be by the EU regulators to require for any GMO product to be put on the market. Well, he discovered, quite accidentally and to his surprise, that GMOs were very unsafe. Within 10 days, his supposedly harmless GMO potato caused potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system. So he went public with his concerns and was a hero for about 2 days at his prestigious institute. Then two phone calls from the UK Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to the director, changed the tone of the director dramatically, and the next day, Dr. Pusztai was fired after 35 years. He was silenced with threats of a lawsuit. They never implemented the testing protocols. Instead, they embarked on a campaign to destroy his reputation. Well, after 7 months of him unable to respond to the lies that were being put out against him, there was an order from Parliament to speak before Parliament, which lifted the gag order. And then it all broke loose in Europe. There was about 700 or more articles written within a single month when his gag order was lifted. And 10 weeks later, a tipping point of consumer rejection was achieved, in which the amount of coverage related to GMO safety was so substantial that the average consumer was not willing to risk themselves or their families on the GMOs. And so within about a week, most major food companies in Europe committed to stop using GM ingredients. And that's why it's been kicked out, not because of the government in Europe to say no GM food, but because of the same food companies there that sell us, ignorant Americans, GMOs.
If you'd like to join the conversation with Jeffrey Smith on genetically engineered foods, give us a ring at 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context with Ken, Gus, and Marchand, and our guest is Jeffrey Smith, author of Seeds of Deception.
Now, Jeffrey, I want to revisit a train of thought from a moment ago about the regulation and the government oversight, because one of the overarching themes that I see is turning a blind eye to danger. And these are the organizations that are supposed to be protecting the American public, you know, the Food and Drug Administration and others. And, you know, things like aspartame, BPA used in food plastics or linings in soda cans. Aspartame, obviously, is, you know, NutraSweet, the key ingredient to Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi and all these other diet sodas people are led to believe are going to help keep them skinny. GMOs being, you know, like you just mentioned, the smaller testicles in the lab mice. And you know, by inference, we're supposed to take from that, okay, smaller testicles, infertility, sterility. That's exactly what BPA, aspartame does. All of these things so saturating our food market. What kind of end conclusion are we supposed to draw that the major industries and the government are allowing these incredibly dangerous products into our food? And they're selling it as a way to feed the poor. They're saying that we're going to solve world hunger with GMOs, but instead all they're doing is actually decreasing people's sterility. I mean, what are we supposed to, you know, draw from that?
Well, I think that there is a strong case that GMOs are reproductive antagonists. For example, rodents fed genetically modified soy had changes in their testicles, some testicles changed from pink to blue.
Oh, God.
Changes in the uterus and ovaries. Mm-hmm. The DNA of the embryo offspring functioned differently. When female rats were fed GM soy, most of the offspring died within 3 weeks compared to a 10% death rate. The babies were also smaller and could not reproduce. By the third generation on GM soy, most hamsters lost the ability to have babies. They also died at 4 or 5 times the rate, and some had hair growing in their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
In Austria, a government study there showed that mice fed Roundup Ready and BT corn had smaller babies and fewer babies. Now we're seeing in the United States livestock having serious epidemic proportions of failure to either get to conceive or to maintain a pregnancy.
Mm.
Now, it's interesting that there's a lot of factors that can be here. One is that the changes that occur during the genetic engineering process.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it could be the actual gene that they insert and its protein that's created. Three, Roundup-ready crops are sprayed with Roundup, which then goes into the crops and bioaccumulates in the food supply, and that's known to cause endocrine disruptions and kill placental cells, human placental cells, and cause abnormal sperm and decreased sperm rates and problems with development of estrogen and testosterone. But then there's also this new mysterious organism, which was discovered by a team of scientists that was in high concentrations in crops sprayed with Roundup. And it's a tiny organism. It's like the size of a small virus, But it's not a virus. It has properties that make it more like a fungus, but it's never been seen in nature before. And it's now found in high concentrations of aborted fetal tissue in livestock. And when they take this organism and they expose it to a healthy pregnant chicken, it kills the fetus in 24 hours and causes an abortion.
Incredible.
And they're finding it, you know, when certain farms are complaining of widespread lack of fertility, they'll send the aborted fetal tissue or the samples of the feed, and they're finding that the feed is just full of this organism. And this is not something that's been published yet. It's sort of been leaked onto the Internet in a letter to the Secretary.
And the chickens eat it, and we eat the chickens.
Excuse me, Jeffrey and Gus, I believe we have a caller. I'd like to speak to Jeffrey. We'll bring him right up.
Go ahead, caller.
Hello, caller. You're on the air with Jeffrey Smith.
Hi.
And Gus and Ken.
Thanks for this article. I'm really glad you're getting it out there. Maybe some of the resistance will be finally diminished. I had the organic CSA up in Woodbury for quite a while, and we tried to do a lot of the same education. And one of the things that you're talking about with the reproductive problems with livestock was that with the GMO corn, some of the farmers that found that to be the case stopped planting the GMO corn and started buying their feed from non-GMO sources. And the incidences, as said, started dropping off dramatically. But when they started planting non-GMO food crops for their livestock on their own property that had been, planted in GMO, the waste given off by the plants into the soil apparently still contained the contaminants, because when they fed their livestock, the problems resurfaced all over again.
So this is Jeffrey, do you have a comment to make on our caller's observation?
Well, first of all, I've heard a lot of farmers talk about the improved reproductive capacity of their livestock when they switch to non-GMO, the ability to gain weight on less feed because they would obviously assimilated better. As far as residuals go, we know that there's residuals in the soil that for Roundup. Roundup can last actually years and years. The longest recorded half-life for any test was 22 years, although that's very uncommon, and it depends on a lot of factors in the soil. So you could end up with Roundup still in the soil affecting the health of plants years after it's been sprayed. Now, one way that it affects the health of plants is that it chelates or binds with nutrients that make it unavailable to the plants. So that's how it helps kill weeds. It makes the plants less nutritious, and then it promotes soil-borne pathogens which overrun the plant. But if you have that the following year in non-GMO stuff, then you still have a situation where the plant may have lower available nutrients, and you're promoting soil-borne pathogens. Now, some of those pathogens produce mycotoxins that could affect the health of the livestock. The reduction in nutrients also could cause diseases and disorders. I'm hearing that there's a universal deficiency in manganese in livestock. There's also big problems in cobalt, which is B12. I talked to one farmer this week. Selenium was down dramatically in his. So you have a situation where the animals are not getting sufficient nutrients, and so that might be causing some of the disorders. And so the person who's planted it may want to do some kind of remediation, mineral supplementation, et cetera, which is beyond my pay grade.
All right. Thank you very much for that call. I believe we have another caller for Jeffrey.
Yes, we have another caller on the line.
Hello, caller. You're on the air with Ken and Gus, and you're speaking to Jeffrey Smith, author of Seeds of Deception. What's your question or comment?
My question is just to find out if I'm accurate in my belief on something. This is a little bit off a different path of the question. My understanding is that the genetically modified seeds are specifically engineered not to create viable seed from the vegetable or fruit that they produce.
You're talking about the Terminator seeds?
Well, yeah, you can plant this corn, for example. The corn itself will grow, but the seed from that corn will not germinate and create more seed.
I can speak to that. It turns out this is called the Terminator technology, and it is not yet commercialize. It is the intention of the biotech industry to commercialize it, to force farmers to buy seeds year after year. Right now, there are certain seeds, even if they're non-GMO, they're called hybrid seeds, where you can't replant corn hybrids, for example, the next year because they don't perform as well. So you have to buy seeds year after year. But with GMO seeds, actually, they force farmers to sign a contract that they will not replant their seeds. So they accomplish the same thing through legal contracts, and they have sued or threatened hundreds of farmers, with threatened them with legal action.
They're incredibly litigious, and if their crops then cross-contaminate someone who's organic nearby, then they go after them.
Yeah, they could, like with Percy Schmeisser, they contaminated Percy's field with, you know, from nearby fields and from mm-hmm. passing trucks, and Monsanto sued Percy because Percy did as he did what every year before for 50 years. He harvested his canola and replanted it, but because
right.
it contained some of Monsanto's intellectual property, he lost the court case,
yeah.
even at the level of the Supreme Court of Canada.
He should have sued them for contaminating his field.
Thank you very much for that call. I believe we have another caller for Jeffrey.
Yes, we have another caller.
You're speaking to Jeffrey Smith.
Thank you for this and having Jeffrey Smith on. And I'd like to let your listeners know that Jeffrey Smith is going to be the keynote speaker at the Connecticut NOFA Winter Conference on March 3rd.
Fantastic.
And where is that? Where is that?
Manchester Community College in Manchester, Connecticut.
Could you give the date again, please?
March 3rd.
Okay. And where can people get more information about it online?
CTNOFA.org.
Could you say that one more time, please?
CTNOFA.
NOFA.
Thanks very much. And go ahead with your comment, caller, or your question.
Oh, I just wanted to thank you for doing this, and it's such an important issue. We're working with some legislators to try to get GMOs labeled in Connecticut in the next legislative session. And we're also suing Monsanto to prevent them from suing farmers whose seeds are contaminated with GMOs.
Great. That's what we were just talking about.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that call.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the show.
Of course.
Jeffrey, the caller raised that issue of labeling.
Yes.
Could you talk about that?
Very important.
Can people find out? How do they find out whether the food they're eating is genetically engineered material?
Well, there's two answers to that question. First, how do people find out? And second, what's the story with labeling in the country? We have a non-GMO shopping guide available at nongmoshoppingguide.com. It's also an iPhone application for free called Shop No GMO. And we require products to be enrolled in the third-party verification system that backs up non-GMO claims. It's called the Non-GMO Project. And we make it a lot easier for people to avoid GMOs. Now, the four tips that we have for people are, one, either buy products in the shopping guide, two, buy products that are organic because they're not allowed to intentionally have GMOs, although sometimes contamination can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Three, buy products that are labeled voluntarily as non-GMO, and the best label is the Non-GMO Project Verification Label. And four is to learn what the at-risk ingredients are and avoid them, and those are listed in the shopping guide, including all of the derivatives of soy and corn, which is a massive list. So that's the way to do it. Now, people will take some time to learn which brands are non-GMO, but then they just have their new brands and it's easy. So if you're going, you know, you may switch to a natural food store because it's easier to find them there. And people will usually notice a difference. I know some people that switched to non-GMO and they lost weight. They've been trying to lose weight for years. One woman lost 35 pounds in a year. Her husband lost 15. Kids each lost 5. And the only thing they did was switch to non-GMO.
Hmm.
Now, as far as the labeling legislation goes, over 50 countries in the world require labeling of GMOs, but the FDA wants to promote biotechnology, so they ignore the desire of 9 out of 10 Americans who want mandatory labeling to support the economic interests of just 5 biotech companies making GMOs. But most Americans, more than 50%, say they would avoid GMOs if they were labeled.
Which, of course, is why the industry doesn't want them.
Yeah, I know, right?
Jeffrey, exactly why they won't label it. Now, California has a ballot initiative that's going to be on the ballot in November 2012, once we've collected 800,000 signatures. And that could be a watershed moment, a real game changer, because companies will not want to label their products as GMO and lose half their customers.
Such a big
they
market.
Would rather eliminate GMOs. And so rather than not selling stuff in California, which is the 7th largest economy, they will get rid of GMOs, in my opinion. So there's going to be a very intense, heated debate in, you know, the biotech industry will spend tens of millions, if not $100 million, to try and stop consumers from knowing
right.
that they're eating their products.
Right.
And then several, there's been about 14 states that introduced some kind of labeling legislation in the last 12 months, and we see it likely to come up in more states because it seems to be now the new wave as awareness, as our attention is growing on GMOs around the country.
Yeah, the label may as well say, this product deliberately contains poison.
Jeffrey, I think we have another call, right?
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with the WPKN.
Yes. Great show, great stuff. There's a couple of TV channels, Free Speech TV and Link TV, that have been running Monsanto films there for a while. They're really informative. One is about a Canadian farmer who had a suit going against Monsanto for 10 years, and there's another one out there. Just let people know that there are some great things going on about this, including what's going on now on your show. So just keep your eye open for those films and catch in at the NOFA, because that's a nice thing, too. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colin.
Yeah, thank you, Colin.
We have some DVDs and CDs and books available at our site, which is at responsibletechnology.org. But also there you can watch completely free of charge anytime a video called Everything You Have to Know About Dangerous Genetically Modified Foods, another one called Hidden Dangers in Kids' Meals, another one called Your Milk on Drugs, Just Say No. We have audios, an audio called Don't Put That in Your Mouth. So we've got a lot of materials, a lot of articles. You can sign up for our free e-newsletter, Spilling the Beans. I like titles, as you can tell. go to responsibletechnology.org, and that way you can not only get all this free information, but you can sign up for the Tipping Point Network. Now, the Tipping Point Network is based on the concept that a small percentage of shoppers avoiding GMOs will turn them into a marketing liability, as they did in Europe. And so the same companies that have already removed GMOs in Europe, if they see even a slight drop in market share based on growing anti-GMO sentiment in the United States, it'll be like a food industry sell signal to get rid of GMOs quickly before they lose market share in a big way. So we think 5% of U.S. shoppers avoiding GM brands will create a tipping point, and we already have groups that we've helped start in the Bridgeport area, in the Greenwich area when I was out there last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a Tipping Point network of groups around the country and where people can work in their local areas or work on specific targeted demographics. Like we're just now organizing a national campaign to protect babies and children from GMO baby food and infant formula. So we had our first webinar with people interested in going to parents this month. We have another one on January 24th. We're starting a national group for healthcare practitioners with our first webinar on January 10th for them. So we're doing national groups, local groups, and we're also training people to speak on GMOs. We've taught about 750 people.
Mm.
So we're engineering a tipping point against genetically engineered food,
right,
which we think may happen as early as this coming year.
Awareness engineering.
I think you have a question for Jeffrey Marchand.
Yes, I'm wondering. Now, maybe I'm just a little bit more of a malicious thinker than most, but I'm wondering. It seems that these genetically modified foods affect children greatly, and as we know, children are the future, but also as we know...
Which is what makes me angry, because, you know, parents can make their own decisions, but children can't.
Exactly. But what's interesting is, like, I think it was the Carter administration did a study where they said it was in order for the first world to survive, we have to eliminate something insane, like 700 million, multi-millions of people from the third world. Now, we supply a tremendous amount of this genetically modified seed to the third world. Is there a potential for this to be used as a weapon to population control, if you will?
Well, GMOs in general can be used as a weapon. The bio weapons that are created by our Defense Department are often transgenic.
Mm.
As far as genetically engineering the food supply, there's a problem with the concept in that it affects everyone, and that the self-propagating pollution of the gene pool can outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste, because the pollen travels, the seeds travel. We have no technology to 100% clean it up. So it would be a very stupid idea to deploy a weapon that was destined to go out of control that would come back and bite you.
But the short-sighted people who think, well, whatever, there's too many people anyway, let it out there. You know, like, they obviously don't care because we're polluting the world with depleted uranium shells and nuclear waste all over the place, and we don't care at all what seems to happen. And the idea of this reducing population almost seems like a positive benefit for some of these crazy people.
Well, I have no evidence that this is – I mean, I've got this question a lot. I have no evidence to support an agenda like that. I just can comment that it seems like a stupid idea because you're basically destroying the environment that everything lives in, including whoever might be deploying. Now, we also have some kind of long-term impacts on those that eat it, or potential long-term impacts. The only human feeding study ever published showed that the genes inserted into soybeans that make the soybeans Roundup ready, meaning that they allow it to be sprayed with Monsanto's Roundup herbicide and not die, those genes transferred into the DNA of bacteria living inside our intestines, and the bacteria was also Roundup ready, suggesting that that gene was now functioning inside us and producing proteins long after we stop eating GMOs. Now, if the other major type of GMO is that we talked about this earlier, the toxin, the insecticide producing corn. Now, imagine eating a corn chip that produces this BT toxin, and the gene that produces it transfers to your gut bacteria. It might turn it into a living pesticide factory. And this may already be happening throughout North America because they tested some pregnant women and unborn fetuses in Canada, and the vast majority had the BT toxin, this insecticide, in their blood.
Wow.
So it's possible that it was being produced continuously from inside the intestinal bacteria, which means we have basically created a monster, or lots of little monsters, inside of us.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming in WPKN.org. Name of the program, In Context. And we're speaking with Jeffrey Smith, the leading scholar on genetically engineered foods. And if you'd like to speak with Jeffrey, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
It sounds almost like the legacy of Agent Orange or depleted uranium. It's just something that doesn't go away. It's persistent in you and your children.
It's far worse than that. I mean, Agent Orange will go away. DDT does break down. It's still all over. PCBs are found in the blood of polar bears right now, but it will diminish over time. With GMOs, it persists because it self-propagates. So it'll outlast, as I say, global warming and nuclear waste, unless we have some kind of sci-fi future where you can wear the goggles to see it and zap it with the ray gun, which may happen, but right now we have no technology to recall it. So there should have been every possible excuse not to deploy it, but what we have instead is a government willing to ignore the science, allow the industry's rigged research to support fake approvals of stuff that should never have been approved in the first place.
Now, you mentioned Roundup and Roundup Ready. Could you explain what that means? What is Roundup and what's a Roundup Ready seed?
Roundup is an herbicide. It's the best-selling herbicide in the world. It's produced by Monsanto. It was originally patented as a chelator, which means it binds with nutrients and doesn't make them available. And so that's one of the properties that allows it to kill plants. Monsanto has falsely advertised their Roundup as biodegradable, and they got convicted in both a U.S. and a European court for lying about that. They have falsely claimed that it is safe for consumption, even though they were aware that it was linked to birth defects since the 1980s, and they hid that information, as did the regulators who approved it. It's now the subject of a lot of studies showing serious problems with human beings, and it is sold in conjunction with the seeds. Most of the genetically modified seeds are created to be herbicide tolerant, which means they don't die when sprayed with a weed killer that would normally kill them. So you can spray over the top of a field and more easily do the weeding. And that's the whole reason we have these GMOs, is so that farmers can weed their field without walking the field or without mixing other chemicals. And so it's increased the use of Roundup dramatically. There's an increase in overall pesticide use or herbicide use in the United States by about 383 million pounds over the first 13 years. That's about 5% increase. But it's increased It's growing much more now because the weeds are becoming smarter than the Roundup. They're developing resistance to it. And so in the last year of the study, there was an increase of herbicide by 31%. So it's accelerating now
right. At
unprecedented amounts. And now you can find in 60 to 100% of the samples, in the air and rainwater in the Midwest, you're finding Roundup. So we're breathing it, we're drinking it, we're eating it, and our kids are rolling around in it on the lawns.
That's incredible. Is this also linked to the dying of the bees?
You know, there's links in the following way. First of all, it's more likely to be a seed treatment which causes an insecticide called, it's a, from nicotine, it's neonicotinoid seed treatments. But there's higher levels of the colony collapse disorder for bees in the United States than overseas where certain GMOs are not planted. So we think that the difference may be related to the compromised immune system, which has been seen in at least one study on bees, where the bees exposed to the BT pollen, which is the BT designed to kill insects, it didn't kill them directly, but that group had a viral infestation that the control group did not have.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the GMOs, the corn varieties, have much higher levels of this seed treatment usually, and so they're more deadly, we think, to the bees. And so there's certainly a linked in, but not necessarily the primary cause.
Jeffrey, I believe we have another caller for you. We'll bring him right up.
Go ahead, caller.
On the air.
Okay. Hi. About the Roundup, there was a film, Inner Alert, and it had on there that not only is the GMO portion, but in Japan there was over 700 people hospitalized from an exposure. And it was found out when they broke it all down that it wasn't even the GMO part. It was one of the inerts in it. And I was just wondering if there's become a better way to find out the inerts and their properties, since being an inert, it doesn't have to be labeled or be honest about any part of it.
Let me explain what that is to the audience. You see, glyphosate is the name of the actual chemical that supposedly does the killing to the plant. But there's about 80 different other components of Roundup, I'm told. Roundup that combines glyphosate with these other, including what's called a surfactant, which allows the Roundup to penetrate into the plant, deeply into the plant. And the surfactant also can allow the glyphosate to penetrate into our skin as well, because it breaks through cell barriers. So the glyphosate turns out in some studies to be far more toxic when it's mixed with the other ingredients of Roundup. In some cases, only Roundup will show a problem and where glyphosate won't. But Roundup, both have been implicated in birth defects, and Roundup more so in killing placental cells in humans in test tubes. And so as far as is there a better way to understand these supposedly inert, non-active ingredients, unfortunately, the regulatory agencies are largely manipulated by the companies that they regulate. So we don't have the full understanding of what they are and what their impacts are. And they also don't test at extremely low dose, which we know can cause endocrine disruption at parts per billion and even high parts per trillion. But that's not evaluated by the regulatory agency because they're going with science, which is obsolete.
Now, thank you very much for that call.
Thanks.
Now, we just have 5 minutes left in our program with Jeffrey Smith, so if you'd like to get your call in before the end of the show, give us a ring now at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
Jeffrey, we do have an email from a couple of listeners. Suzanne is out there. She says she's really enjoying the show. She wanted to know about labeling, but we already talked about that. I have another email from Michael, and his email I'm not fully informed on, but I'll pose it to you to see if you have a comment. And he asks, would Jeffrey please discuss the horizontal genetic transfer, which can take place in the gut, and the upshot of illness as a result? And he says, specifically, I'm interested in the agrobacterium DNA making its way into the human genome. He says there was a 2007 SUNY study of the recent Morgellon syndrome, which found the cellulose fibers produced from skin lesions of sufferers contained agrobacterium DNA. In the case, it seems the bacteria used was GMOs are acting in conjunction with environmental toxins, and it deserves a closer examination, but he doesn't expect it from the CDC.
That's a pretty complicated question. I'll break it down for the audience. Thank you for that. I don't know if I've covered all in 5 minutes, so I'll give you the quick version.
We talked about horizontal
gene transfer, where the gene can transfer from soybeans into gut bacteria and potentially continue to function, and how the BT toxin may be produced continuously inside our intestines because of a transfer of the BT gene from corn chips. So that's horizontal gene transfer, where you put a gene in. Normally, there are strong barriers to prevent plant genes from making their way into the DNA of bacteria inside us, but those barriers have been dismantled with GMOs. Now, Morgellons is a very horrible disease. You can look it up on the internet. I don't want to describe the horrible symptoms, but
yeah,
you can look it up.
I'm familiar with it.
And they found that in certain skin lesions, they found what's called agrobacterium. And now, I mentioned there's two ways to create a GMO. One was a gene gun. The other was to use bacteria to smuggle it in. And the bacterium that they use is called agrobacterium. And since they found the agrobacterium on the skin of human beings, many people suspect that the source of this disease is some kind of experimental GMO, or possibly even one of the GMOs that are out there that are approved for commercial consumption. We don't have enough information to make a conclusive statement about that. It's just that it's certainly a big red flag when they found a component of the genetic engineering process on the skin of victims of this horrible disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned the guide to non-GMO foods. Are there any other recommendations that you have, Jeffrey, for how people can deal with this situation in our last couple minutes here on the show?
Well, first of all, I want to say that when given a choice, many species of animals avoid GMOs. I hear stories about this all the time. And so a lot of people will avoid all of the scientific discussion that we've had and just realize that when cows, pigs, geese, elk, deer, squirrels, mice, rats, and buffalo, and as well as dogs, avoid GMOs when given a choice, in many circumstances, that becomes the third-party support that they need. So getting motivated is the first thing. I would say that, you know, it's something that we have to protect pregnant women and very young children especially. The time of pregnancy is when whatever the mother eats can have impacts on the children, and animal feeding studies have shown it can even impact the next generation.
Right, and you're affecting your children's entire lives. It's not
exactly.
it's their development. It's not something that, you know, you catch a cold and you get better. This is something that you're feeding into the development of the fetus, into a future adult who will then have children. Well, we thank you so much for joining us today.
Great show. Thanks a lot,
Jeffrey. The website is responsibletechnology.org. And the book is Seeds of Deception, among others. Jeffrey, is there anything else you want to mention?
Well, non-GMOshoppingguide.com. And if anyone wants to make a year-end donation, we are needing it because we're creating a tipping point and struggling to keep up with all the low-hanging non-GMO fruit we're creating. So if you want to make an end-of-year donation, it would be great. Go to Responsible Technology and give us a gift, and we will use it well.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
We'll be on
next week, next Monday, December 26th, with our War Report.
Yeah,
we'll see you then.
Find us on Facebook.
InContextReport.com.
Thanks, Marge.
Thanks, Marge. Bye-bye, listeners. Thanks for listening. 5FM in Bridgeport.